Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
She's your sunshine. You'd do absolutely anything for her. So what will her world be like? Will she be safe? Will she make enough to live on? You've been reading Bible stories to her. Will she be free to share her faith, to say what she thinks about the truth, to live it out there in the real world? You'd do absolutely anything for her. So vote. Your faith, your vote, her future.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
The talk you are about to hear was given at the C.S. Lewis Group at Ulster's Spring Mini Symposium. The event was titled C.S. Lewis and the Land of His Birth, Rerouting Lewis in Ulster and the Island of Ireland. Dr. David Clare is a lecturer in drama and theatre studies at Mary Immaculate College, University of Limerick. The title of his talk at the symposium was Lit Up Inside, C.S. Lewis's Joy and Ulster Protestant Ecstasy.
Another Belfast playwright from a working-class loyalist Presbyterian family who came to strongly embrace her Irishness as an adult is the world-renowned hitmaker Mari Jones, author of the international stage successes Stones in His Pockets from 1999 and the play I'll be discussing here, A Night in November from 1994. A Night in November is a monologue play involving one actor that is written in the form of a testimony, such as one might hear in an evangelical or charismatic fellowship. In this case, however, we're not told about a person's conversion to Christianity. Instead, we learn about how a Belfast Protestant converted, quote unquote, from Britishness to Irishness. The main character is called Kenneth Norman McAllister, and he works as a dole clerk in Belfast and has just been accepted for membership at the local golf club, where only Protestants, accidentally, are only ever accepted as members. This is a sign of how far he's come socioeconomically from an early childhood spent in a deprived loyalist area. The rise began with his parents' relative financial success, which enabled them to move their family to a more middle-class area, and later Kenneth's own solid career within the civil service, plus his marriage to a middle-class unionist woman called Deborah, has solidified his bourgeois status. However, a series of incidents, most notably witnessing appalling racist and sectarian behavior by Northern Ireland football fans during a World Cup qualifying match against the Republic of Ireland in Windsor Park, and getting to know his Catholic work colleague Jerry much better, makes him question certain aspects of his British political allegiance. In particular, Kenneth, like a character from a Christina Reid play, wonders if the sectarianism and sense of being a chosen people, sometimes found among militant hardcore loyalists, leads inevitably to racism against people of color and ethnic minorities. Second, he wonders if the need to appear very British leads many middle-class Protestant unionists to perform what Belfast-based champion of Ulster Protestant writing Edna Longley has scathingly dubbed an ersatz Englishness, complete with the hyper-neat homes and gardens, a degree of emotional repression, and the willful ignoring of violence done in one's name. Kenneth is also envious of Catholics being able to freely express an Irishness that he's been taught to suppress or even deny his whole life. In the end, Kenneth sells his golf clubs and combines that money with the funds he was to have used to pay his golf club fees in order to fly to New York to support the Republic of Ireland as they play Italy in the 1994 World Cup match. He's delighted to be regarded as just, quote, one of the lads, end quote, by the Irish fans he falls in with, despite his Belfast Protestant background. He ends the play by proudly asserting, in the full throes of the ecstasy associated with the sudden conversion experience, quote, I am a free man, I am a Protestant man, I'm an Irish man, end quote. On this occasion, Kenneth is dedicating his life not to Jesus, but to the island of Ireland. A Night in November was first produced by Double Joint Productions at the West Belfast Festival in August 1994, starring the great East Belfast Protestant actor and son of a shipyard worker, Dan Gordon. It subsequently toured across Ireland and then went to the Tricycle Theatre in London and various theatres in the New York City metropolitan area. And I actually first saw it at the Helen Hayes Theatre in Nyack, New York. Its first Dublin appearance was at Andrews Lane Theatre, and it would later be revived at the Gaiety, where I saw it again. And Fintan O'Toole, reviewing a show during the Andrews Lane run for the Irish Times, wrote one of the most negative reviews of his career. In the review, O'Toole is highly critical of what he sees as the play's crude stereotyping of Ulster Protestant Unionists and Catholic Nationalists from across the island. He also condemns the play's misogyny as manifested in Kenneth's rude remarks about and actions towards his wife and her female friends. And he's disgusted by the idea of Dublin audiences rooting for a man who irresponsibly abandons his wife and kids to head to a football match in the United States. All of these criticisms make perfect sense if A, you regard Kenneth as a reliable narrator who's meant to be admired wholeheartedly, and B, you believe that Mari Jones shares all of Kenneth's views regarding women, nationality, football, and all else. Once more, we come face to face with an instance of a Dublin critic, and in this case, a frequently brilliant one, not being familiar enough with Ulster Protestant culture. For Ulster Protestants know that when a new convert stands up to give their testimony, one must make allowance for the zeal of the convert, which includes a marked degree of spiritual immaturity. And they're also aware that with testimonies, a person's personality will still shine through, compromising to varying degrees, depending on the person, the trustworthiness of their narrative. To make it clear to audiences that Kenneth is narrating this story from a place of naivete and without nuance regarding national identity, Jones, in collaboration with her son, Matthew McElhenney, created a new framing scenes to open and close the play when it was revived with Matthew directing in 2019. These new top and tail scenes depict an older Kenneth supporting Northern Ireland in the Euro 2016 tournament in France. This shows us that Kenneth, when not in the first flush of conversion, eventually gained more maturity when examining issues around national identity. His re-engagement with the Northern Ireland team implicitly signals that, in the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement, he is presumably still comfortable with his Irishness, but also acknowledging that his Protestant roots in the Six County mean his identity also contains Britishness. Use of this clever framing device in future productions will hopefully help audience members without knowledge of Ulster Protestant culture or evangelical and charismatic culture to see that the light of testimony is always refracted through the prism of the person delivering it. In the wake of the C.S. Lewis centenary celebrations in 1998, artists, critics, and the general public in Northern Ireland began to pay much more attention to Jack's ties to Ulster. No doubt, this increased awareness was greatly helped by the 1998 unveiling of Ross Wilson's sculpture, The Searcher, on the Newtownards Road, in what would be later become C.S. Lewis Square, as well as the appearance of two key books, David Bleakley's C.S. Lewis, At Home in Ireland from 1998, and most especially Ronald W. Breslin's important and influential study, The Backward Glance, C.S. Lewis in Ireland from 1999. A clear sign of Lewis's increased visibility in the North was the conscious referencing of his work by writers from the Six Counties over recent decades. To give just two examples, Belfast writer Rosemary Jenkinson, from a mixed Presbyterian and Church of Ireland background, refers to Lewis as, quote, our shining northern light, end quote, in an Irish Times article she wrote in 2021. And there's an arguably gratuitous reference to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in the final episode of the brilliant award-winning television series Derry Girls, written by Lisa McGee, raised in a Roman Catholic family in Derry's Bogside. In this final section of my paper, I want to look at two other contemporary Ulster writers who have been influenced by Lewis and who include moments of ecstasy in their work. Singer-songwriter Juliet Turner from a Methodist farming family in Chomery County, Tyrone, and Lucy Caldwell, the Belfast-born daughter of an Ulster Protestant father and an English mother of Irish Catholic descent, who, although raised in a secular household, was educated at what folks in the North would regard as Protestant schools, even the technically non-denominational Strathern School. Juliet Turner first came to many people's attention when she performed a deeply moving version of Christian singer Julie Miller's song Broken Things at the memorial service for the victims of the real IRA's despicable bombing of Omagh's town center in August 1998. She subsequently released two of the strongest albums by an Irish singer-songwriter from recent decades. 2000's Burn the Black Suit, which led to high-profile support slots for the likes of U2 and Sting, and 2005's Season of the Hurricane, which earned her a Meteor Award for Best Irish Female Performer. Turner retired from music in the 2010s to become a speech therapist. Turner's Methodist upbringing, as well as her temporary involvement in a charismatic Church of Ireland fellowship in Dublin in her 20s, are reflected in the spiritual occupations, as well as the allusions to the work of C.S. Lewis found in some of her lyrics. For example, she references Lewis's novel about heaven and hell, The Great Divorce, in the song The Signal and the Noise. And the track Rough Lion's Tongue includes imagery clearly inspired by Aslan stroke Narnia. Quote, "Is it too rude to ask for a wild sea of grace, for a burning at dawn on a pyre of mistakes, between the shore where I lie old and the shore where I lay young, lick the salt from my face with your rough lion's tongue," end quote. Of course, this portion of the song and the rest of the track's lyrics contain a mixing of the sacred and the profane, the spiritual and the carnal, that Stuart Parker's Pentecost characters would appreciate. Another link to Lewis and to the other writers examined in this paper is Turner's inclusion of moments of ecstasy in her work. One particularly striking example is her song Everything Beautiful is Burning, the lead single from Season of the Hurricane. It tells the story of someone who wakes up at 3 a.m. having gone through a particularly stressful period of life. The protagonist had a sorrow that was secret and felt like everything beautiful was burning, a situation made worse by the fact that, quote, it felt like everyone close to them was leaving, end quote. This led to our hero living recklessly, but here in the depth of night, having had a panic attack, they have a moment of clarity in which, quote, the tightness of years fell from their face, end quote. They find a way to not only keep going, but to approach the future with hope. Quote, I watch you rise from the ashes, pale but dignified. It was a close call by anyone's standards, a free fall into the dark. All your ghosts lift their glasses and drink a silent toast to your recovery. Here it comes, that sweet sunshine. Don't turn your face away from the first light of the sunlight. Don't turn your face away when all the signs say that it's here to stay, end quote. It's a moment of private spiritual ecstasy that has led to a letting go of the past and a vow to move forward in a positive frame of mind. Lucy Caldwell may have been educated in Protestant schools, but when it came to representing Ulster evangelicals in her work, she felt that she was not totally equipped to capture their mindset due to having been raised in a non-religious household and due to possessing a personal spirituality, which, in her own words, is closer to Buddhism than other religions. As such, during the research period for her second novel, The Meeting Point, which is about an Irish evangelical family on a missionary posting in Bahrain, she attended an Alpha course, an 11-week program of talks and discussions, which introduces people to the basics of Christianity from an essentially evangelical point of view. This deep dive into the evangelical mindset has stood to Caldwell when writing not only The Meeting Point, but also her later fiction about evangelicals, most famously her story, All the People Were Mean and Bad, which won the BBC National Short Story Award in 2021. Caldwell's longstanding interest in spirituality, extending back to childhood, has also manifested itself in a consistent engagement with the work of C.S. Lewis. From the age of 12, she lived quite near Little Lee in Belmont, which obviously gave her a sense of connection to Jack, but her interest in Lewis preceded that house move. Indeed, she told me via email that, quote, I grew up on the Chronicles of Narnia and loved them deeply, not least because the favorite child, so it always seemed to me, shared my first name, end quote. She also reminded me of an allusion to Lewis in her 2022 novel about the Belfast Blitz, These Days, quote, in chapter 13, Florence's first chapter, the family walks to church at St. Mark's Dundella, then containing the stained glass window paid for by the Lewis family, and passes what her children always called the Green Hills, the lower Craigantlet Hills, just visible of the above the up the Cairnburn Road, beyond the tops of the sycamores and oaks. The Green Hills is how we always thought of those hills, tumbled together in my memory with the hymn, There is a Green Hill Far Away, as perhaps it was for the Lewis children, who also referred to them that way. I pointed out to Caldwell that, like her, I had always assumed that Jack and Warney's use of Green Hills for that part of the county down landscape was likely derived from that classic hymn by C. Francis Fanny Alexander, who, although born in Dublin, lived in Strabane, County Tyrone, and Derry, Londonderry for most of her life. And I pointed out to her that, on a related note, Lewis includes a pointed reference to a green hill in the story that Lucy reads in the Magician's Spell Book in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. C.S. Lewis's presence in Caldwell's fiction is most notable in her short story Through the Wardrobe, which was commissioned and broadcast by BBC Radio 4 in 2013, and which later appeared in her outstanding 2016 short story collection Multitudes. Caldwell noted to me that in frequently passing Little Lee during her formative years, she was keenly aware that the house, quote, contained the wardrobe that famously inspired Narnia, end quote. And Caldwell uses this image of the wardrobe in a story rife with images from Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia and from fairy tales. Through the Wardrobe is a highly compassionate account of a child assigned male at birth who's experiencing significant gender dysphoria and who's eventually liberated by taking a gold lamé dress from a sister's wardrobe and trying it on while staring into the mirror inside that wardrobe. Caldwell's sympathy for the child's struggles is wonderfully captured in the passage that is the story's longest engagement with Lewis's work. We are privy to the child's thoughts when they receive a male Disney costume as a Christmas gift instead of the female one that they had desired. Quote, you feel your body turn to stone, to ice, as if you're one of the statues that Polly and Diggory from The Magician's Nephew find in the cursed hall of the Enchanted Palace. Your mum has been reading you and your next oldest sister that book at bedtime, and it gives you nightmares. The thought of all the people trapped inside bodies that are theirs and not theirs, bodies they can't control or even worse, victims of some wicked spell, end quote. The final paragraphs of Caldwell's story make clear what a revelatory moment the trying on of the gold dress is. It is a moment of self-discovery that we are informed via the narration will help sustain the protagonist through the many difficult years ahead of them. In other words, it is a relatively brief moment of ecstasy that is transformative. This paper has explored only a selection of depictions of individual and or communal ecstasy in works by Ulster Protestant writers. One might also discuss Helen Waddell's play, The Spoiled Buddha, in which Bin Zuru, inspired by a woman's beauty, enters a dream state in which he glimpses the infinite. The use of ecstatic dance and physical movement in several Theatre of the Image plays by Cavan Presbyterian playwright Tom McIntyre, most of which premiered at the Abbey Theatre's Peacock Space in the 80s and 90s. Neil Hannon, son of a Church of Ireland bishop, being inspired to choose peace over tribal difference as a new day dawns in the Divine Comedy song Sunrise. The praise chorus Euphoria of Relish's 2001 track Rainbow Zephyr, in which admittedly the Downpatrick band celebrate a weather phenomenon, not the maker of heaven and earth. The open-hearted surrender and devotion in Snow Patrol songs such as Run, Chasing Cars, and The Planet Bends Between Us, in which Campbell College alum Gary Lightbody sings, backed by fellow Campbell old boy Johnny Quinn and Grosvenor Grammar School alum Nathan Connolly, that he will, quote, race to the edge of Ireland and shout out loud, it's all for you, end quote. The otherworldly performance of Everlasting Love during the grandfather's funeral in Kenneth Branagh's 2021 film Belfast, and key moments of private transformation in recent fiction by Wendy Erskine, Jane Carson, and the aforementioned Jenkinson. Clearly, the inclusion of spiritual, that is, soul-deep moments of ecstasy that bring transcendence and or conversion is a persistent trope in Ulster Protestant writing. These moments are less merely intellectual than, for example, the epiphanies of James Joyce, or the embracing of the darkness in the work of Samuel Beckett. More research must be undertaken to understand and theorize this Ulster-Irish literary trope, and undoubtedly such research will uncover more links to C.S. Lewis's moments of joy in his classic memoir, Surprised by Joy. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
All of us have wondered what happens after we die, and I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life today. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. Go now to premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. And don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
Thanks for a fascinating paper. Music, it's really interesting you bringing together music and theatre. Is music always a common denominator in this?
That's a good question, yeah, because it's definitely central to even a lot of the theatre performances, you know, such as Pentecost, you know. I think music is huge. I think it's intimately tied. I mean, music, I've talked before about the fact that Irish theatre in particular has, and I'm not talking about musicals here, I'm talking about literary dramas. You regularly have characters just burst into song, or where there's a very strategic use of instrumental music. And I think that's a feature of plays from across the island generally. But I definitely think that within the, let's say, Ulster playwrights, you have it a lot more explicitly linked to sort of emotional breakthroughs and sort of, yeah, as we say, ecstatic experiences. So I do think that's crucial. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I'm working on my own an essay at the minute about the Presbyterian voice, and I'm actually looking a little bit about Bono's memoir, Surrender, and I just, your discussion there about the open-hearted surrender, I just wonder if you see any kind of connection between...
Yeah, hugely. I mean, I was actually, when in the middle of writing this, I don't know why, but I ended up watching U2's Live Aid performance. And I was completely thinking to myself, oh God, this is Protestant ecstasy. And, you know, how am I going to fit that in? Because the Ulster thing's not there or whatever. But I think what's going on there is that it's not like there aren't people from the 26 counties, you know, who have this experience of evangelical and or charismatic Christianity that kind of makes them lean towards the inclusion of ecstatic experiences. And U2 would be one of the most prominent examples of that. You're actually even starting to see it among the new Irish as well, if we think about rap artists like God Knows or Denise Chyla, people who would identify as Christian and yet would also have these ecstatic moments in the songs and things like that. So I don't want to say it's, you know, just the province of Ulster, but at the same time, it's just kind of more predominant up here.
Right. It's also interesting just that his title, Surrender, is kind of a sly reference also to Ian Paisley. You know, he kind of makes
the... So it's the No Surrender thing. Like, there was the controversial biography of Van Morrison that had that allusion in the title as well. I mean, I think surrender's been a huge concept for Bono from the beginning. There's a song on the War album, the third album, in which spiritual surrender is talked about. And I remember him talking in different interviews about the importance of surrender. And he talked about mountain goats and how to allow each other to pass. One will actually go down and the other will go over the top of it and all this kind of stuff. So spiritual surrender has always been huge for him. And I think that as I've written elsewhere, actually, the North has always been huge for him because he's often slagged in the press, in the Republic, for highlighting instances of sectarianism during his childhood. But we have to remember that in U2's early years, they were actually regularly persecuted by a group calling themselves the Black Catholics, who were very, very angered that all four of them were attending what was effectively a Protestant charismatic fellowship, and three of the four were actually from Protestant backgrounds. So that and other sort of tensions, strangely on the north side of Dublin, were the kind of things he was talking about and that inevitably drew his attention to the north. And I think also I've talked before about the fact that on any other Friday, he would have been where one of the bombs went off during the Dublin-Monaghan bombing in 1974, because he always passed through that street on a Friday, but there happened to be a when he went between two buses, but actually there was a bus strike on, so he actually cycled to school that day, and that's how he missed it. His best friend, Googie's brother, was actually caught up in it and was permanently damaged by the carnage that he saw as part of the bombing. And lost his faith for a while, but came back to it. So I think that's why we get Sunday Bloody Sunday. That's why we get, you know, playing at the concert for the Good Friday Agreement and all those different other kinds of manifestations of interest in the North that more people in the 26 counties could be bothered to show, one would hope. But anyway, that's my... See, down, the begrudgery is so strong against Bono and the Republic that I'm always kind of embarrassed talking about him. But I'm just going to be brave and put my Bono heart on my sleeve there for a second.
Thanks very much, David, for a great paper. It was brilliant. I'm just thinking about something that you didn't mention, which was in that hideous strength, Lewis. You know, that famous scene where the ecstatic scenes where the Adels come down. And there's one character who doesn't seem to enter into it, and it's McPhee. And McPhee's the Ulsterman.
Yeah.
So why is it that all these people can enter into these ecstasies as these heavenly bodies descend and everyone gets wrapped up in it? And poor old McPhee's there in his grey robes, not quite being able to enter into that. Do you think Lewis was, I don't know, was he on the one hand playing with the archetype of the Dour Ulsterman, and then at the same time playfully pointed out, well, he has written this wonderful work and he is writing about the ecstasy. So I don't know what you thought about that.
You know, that's a great, great link to make. Yeah, and more needs to be said about those ecstatic experiences in that novel. McPhee, I've always taken, and I've said somewhere, I feel is based on Kirkpatrick, you know, the former headmaster of Lurgan College that was his tutor in Surrey during some of his quote-unquote English years when he was living in effectively an Ulster household. And the thing about Kirkpatrick, the great knock, is that he had rejected the Presbyterianism in which he was raised and, in Lewis's famous words, was a purely logical being. And so I think that if McPhee is based on the great knock, then he's stubbornly refusing to get caught up in an ecstatic experience, and he's going to remain a purely logical being, which, you know.
Thanks, David. Fascinating paper as ever.
Thanks.
I appreciated your reference there to Fintan O'Toole, who, as you say, is usually a pretty clear-eyed writer. But I lived in Dublin for many years and lived and worked with professional class people. And I found that there was always this sort of myopic sort of view of the other, as they saw it in the North, and a complete lack of understanding. I remember meeting one chap who saw me reading The Observer, and he says, "Oh," he says, "I didn't know you were conservative." Even something as minor as that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I often found. You'd have otherwise very intelligent people who absolutely haven't a clue about what goes on as they see it, the other side of the divide, not only on the and I hate these expressions, Protestant Unionist Loyalist versus Catholic Nationalist Republican. but I think there is an inability to see what's going on, but also because that narrative very rarely penetrates further south, as I see it.
Yeah, well, I think that there's been a reluctance to engage with the specificity of the hybridity, I suppose, of the Ulster Protestant person in terms of both the British and Irish cultural inheritance that they share. And I remember being in Crawford's Burn Inn for the first time and just feeling like, this is C.S. Lewis. There was some eeriness there where I was feeling the strong Irish energy and the strong British energy like at the same time, and going like, how are you going to capture that? So I think what can sometimes happen, like, we know Fintan O'Toole's been so brilliant on decrying Republican violence in the North.
Yes.
And yet, and he's obviously very affirming of folks identifying as British should they wish to. And yet there's, sometimes you feel like maybe he hasn't fully interrogated what that word British contains. In the sense that, well, how does Ulster Britishness manifest itself? Or is he just kind of saying they're identifying as British in exactly the same way as somebody in England, Scotland, or Wales would identify as British, and not necessarily seeing what that particular flavor of Britishness might look like?
Just to finish on this one, David, the other aspect that a lot of people further south absolutely miss is the connection with the armed forces and with the police and so on then as well. And how that is, like, not, you know, very few of any families, to my knowledge, because I, as you know, I've spent the last year dealing with becoming part of the Church of Ireland locally in a cross-border parish. Yeah. And I don't see any understanding of that further south in the sort of the broader popular discussion of, like, why somebody, like, it's just seen as this sort of almost cartoonish sort of an image.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, so hopefully if we keep drawing attention to the richness and complexity of the province of Ulster, you know, as a whole,
yes,
and, you know, I know you've got Donegal connections, and I deliberately was talking about Donegal in this. I was talking about a Cavan Presbyterian playwright like Tom McIntyre. Yes. And I have to think about, you know, Protestant friends of mine, not just from Cavan and Donegal, but also Monaghan, and kind of recognize the similarities that they have, obviously, to folks in the six counties. Yes. In terms of an Ulster Protestant identity and cultural inheritance. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. What would you recommend for people who are not that familiar with C.S. Lewis' works as the essential books, or the most essential?
Yeah, so it was my... we were having this debate actually in November, to talk with Peter Linkins and others about that. And probably my choices are probably unusual. I mean, obviously, Chronicles of Narnia, and I was speaking to you earlier and talked about how That Hideous Strength is my favorite of the cosmic trilogy, but that a lot of people don't necessarily share that view. I love Screwtape Letters. I love, in terms of the theology, you know, you can't go wrong with Mere Christianity. In terms of the essay collections, there's a lot of great stuff in The Weight of Glory, but actually I could read his essays all day and all night, so I suppose signaling anything out feels like a piece of impertinence. I'm sure I'm missing something absolutely major. Until We Have Faces is great, and I have many friends who've thought that that was actually the greatest novel. That's, you know, that there's a case to be made for that. Yeah, I probably haven't narrowed it down that much.
Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, great. I thank you very much, David.
Sure. Thanks, Wayne Curtis. Thanks, everyone. Thanks so much.
That was the second part of Dr. David Clare's talk from the C.S. Lewis Group at Ulster's Spring Mini Symposium. They have another symposium in Belfast this November the 4th called C.S. Lewis and Last Things: How the Writer of Narnia Saw the End of Our Story. I'll include a link of how to find out more about this in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.